Podcast. In conversation with musicians from the UK jazz scene. And now your hosts, Rob Cope and Dan Farrant.
Welcome to the Jazz Podcast. It's episode 7, and this week we're talking to Laura Judd. But before we talk to Laura, let's talk to Dan.
Hi, Rob.
Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm very well. How are you, Rob?
I'm very good. How's the weather in Barcelona this morning?
It is very sunny. It's nice and not too hot, not too cold. Yeah, it's great here.
It's Formula One winter testing is in Barcelona at the moment.
So is that right?
Yeah, I feel strangely connected to you in terms of what the weather's doing at any given moment.
Okay, do I need to put on my slicks or my hards?
I think probably some hard tires this morning.
Yeah, is
perfect.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. So how's the UK doing?
The UK is, it's good. I guess we're all just hanging in there waiting for the clocks to go forwards.
Oh, that's coming up, isn't it?
Yeah, that's soon.
26th or something.
Yeah, that'll be glorious.
26th. Great. So, what's going on in the news this week? Have you had any more gigs?
No, I'm afraid it's over forever now.
Ugh.
Yeah, I know. It's a shame. But my rather fortunate run of being actually doing stuff
busy,
is over.
You were busy for a week or something, weren't you?
I was very busy. Yeah. That was well over a week. This week in the news, that's not very newsy, that one, was it?
No, that wasn't. That was more, I don't know what that was.
My standard one is ba 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 ba.
Yeah. That one's better, is it, really?
Brass fall at the end.
Sure.
In the news, Julian Siegel's Jazz Orchestra is going on a tour of Britain starting next week on Tuesday the 14th in Leicester, home of the Premier League champions, followed by the next night in Nottingham, which I think is the knife crime capital of Britain.
Is that right? Is it really? I thought that was North London.
Oh, maybe maybe it's dependent on the population, like the percentage of people in the city that
per capita knife crimes per citizen, is it, or something?
That's a hilarious plural you've just created: knife crimes per citizen.
Anyway,
and then Ronnie's on Thursday with Nick Smart's band Black Eyed Dog, and then Lincoln Friday in Lincoln, hometown of Tom Corley, who's soon to come on the show. Wow.
That's going to be a really boring episode, isn't it?
That's going to be an absolute steamer. We're going to have a great time. If you like listening to me being character assassinated, then you'll enjoy the show. Because Tom doesn't hold anything back.
Who's on the podcast this week?
Laura Judd.
Oh, great. I wasn't around to do this one. I was in Blackpool at a magic convention, so I missed this recording.
Nice. Well, that's a wonderful reason to not have been. The magic convention. How was the magic convention?
Well, apart from it being in Blackpool, it was good.
Yeah. Do you show each other tricks?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, it's about 3,500 magicians get together.
Oh man,
and it's pretty intense.
I can well believe it.
Mm.
What do you have to do to get a ticket to that?
Just buy one. How was Laura's episode?
Oh, it was great. My wife Claire sits in, and so does Elliot Galvin, Laura's partner. So it's quite a nice group collective discussion. Mm. And there's some kind of musical extravaganza on the end. So it's a reward for anyone that goes all the way to the end of the show to check out what's going on. But don't skip to it. That's definitely cheating.
Yeah.
If I could put a no skipping function on, I would, and then people would have to crawl to the end.
I think they do that anyway, so
they probably do. Well, with that in mind, let's run the tape.
Yeah.
So Laura, where'd you grow up?
I grew up in a little village in Hampshire called Medstead, just kind of near like the market town of Alton. yeah, small village. Yeah, about 10 minutes away from the nearest town. So.
Do you have any brothers or sisters?
Yeah, I have a brother who is like 7 years older than me.
I thought you were going to say he's seven now.
No,
that Fresh Prince thing where you're like 20 years apart.
Yeah, well, coming on to 20 years apart, I also have a half-sister who is, my dad had her when he was, quite young, about 20 or something. So, and she's actually somewhere in her 40s.
Wow.
I think she's, mid-40s. Maybe she'll listen to this and be like, why don't you know all this? So I have a half-sister and an older brother. So I'm the youngest by a long way in my family.
Wow.
Yeah.
I feel like it's our right, or maybe not our right anymore, because we're getting old. But when you're young, anyone who's older than you, I think you automatically don't know how old they are. I have two older half-brothers and I've got no idea how old they are.
Yeah.
But my younger sister, I know what, I know her age. Or like your parents, uncles.
Yeah, you kind of lose track.
Yeah. As long as you know your own age.
Yeah.
So, do you remember when you first got into music?
Yeah. In a way, for as long as I remember, I've been into music. Grew up with a piano in the family home and... some of my earliest memories just playing on that and improvising, actually, and, sitting at the piano as a toddler and, working out little tunes and stuff. So, to be honest, music has been a part of my life for as long as I remember, really.
I didn't listen to the last bit.
I'm just saying that...
What age did you start piano?
Yeah, well... We had a piano in my house.
Sorry, I was thinking about that jazz... Would I Lie to You? It's such a good idea. And I just thought of a story that I can use.
No.
So you're 10 and you started the piano.
No, it didn't say anything about the age of 10. I'm going to say all of that again.
Okay.
So
it's okay. I've used the answer that you gave me.
Oh, yeah.
Unless it's you want to say it again.
Well, no, I'll just say a concise version for you.
All right.
For as long as I can remember, music has been a huge part of my life. Grew up with a piano in the house, in the family home. And as a toddler, actually, I would, sit at the piano and improvise try and play little tunes I'd heard. And
I'd like to imagine that even as a toddler, you were really, really amazing. profound musical things happening.
I'm not sure about that. But my parents recognised that I obviously really loved playing piano, so I started actually having lessons when I was about five, just about to turn five. So started learning in a more formal way from that point. But I think, I think at that age I didn't know that it was anything special, and I was just playing. I thought, just another part of what I did as a kid, So
you still play piano?
Yeah, I do.
I've seen you. So I ask that knowing full well that you're incredibly good at it. Or at least that's the impression I get.
Yeah, well, I still, I don't play it so much live, I'm primarily a trumpet player, but I, because I write lots of music and I'm a composer, I use the piano a lot when I'm writing. And obviously, I think in terms of piano playing, I did a lot of classical playing, so it's something I quite like to do in my spare time, is go back and play old pieces that I used to learn. Something I'd like to do more of, actually, pursue that again, because I got really into the whole classical piano thing at one stage. And I've always improvised on the piano. I've never really kind of formally learnt the kind of jazz piano thing, but I've always been an improviser on the piano, if you know what I mean. And
I'd go as far as to say that you're the best piano player of all the horn players I know in London.
Oh, that's very good.
Your piano skill. I remember once we were doing a rehearsal or recording. I think it might have been Chaos Orchestra. And Elliot, you were playing the piano and you were playing something, and Laura went, no, no, no. And you went, what about like this? And you played something else. And she went, no, that's still not right. And then she went, get out of the way. And she sat down and played what she wanted. And it was so good. It was way that's better than what you were playing.
I know.
But maybe, but wait a minute. This is fraud, because maybe the only reason I could sound like I knew what I was doing is because perhaps it was a piece that I'd actually written. You know what I mean? So when I say, yeah, there we go.
Yeah.
Secret's out.
Yeah.
So I think I have like reasonable skills as a piano player, but as I say, like the kind of jazz piano thing that actually a lot of my horn player friends, like who play piano as well, have a lot more of that under their fingertips. I think I think I have a my knowledge of harmony I can translate to the piano, but just perhaps not in the I don't know. I think it's the same with my composing, actually. Basically, what I'm saying is I'm a huge fraud. And I think I've mainly, with music, although I know some things, I think I've always had quite an instinctive and intuitive approach to composing, to improvising, you know. So in that sense, it's kind of like the I don't know, the Laura Jerd rule book as opposed to the rule book.
Yeah, I read a great article this morning in which you said, it says in, like, when I Googled you, and it says, Laura Jerd, colon, I just like making stuff up.
Yeah, these very funny primitive quotes that I had associated with me. There's that one. I just like making things up. And it's very true, to be honest, but there's also another a little heading that came with my name, was just like, I like loud music. So I'd like to take this opportunity on this podcast to say that I like music of all dynamics. But yeah, no, I actually think that that's the basis of it, because yeah, you know, when you get asked questions like, if you weren't a musician, what would you want to do?
Yeah,
I always think there's so many things that I'd love to do, but they all involve kind of making stuff up in some way, you know. So yeah, being creative is definitely such a huge part, and I'm particularly attracted to being creative when it comes to sound, so I guess that's why I love music. So it's as simple as that.
Maybe you'd make a fine sound engineer for your like alternative life, you know. Like
I don't know,
be given a film and just figure stuff out.
You mean what kind of thing?
Like noises.
Oh, like those people that make sound effects. Yeah. Well, actually,
the more creative one, like in Star Wars, like Ben Burtt, who did like the Monsters, Inc. films as well, who is Ben Burtt. He's the guy that like, right, what's a lightsaber going to sound like? What's this spaceship going to sound like? And just figuring out, like using like, I don't know, you know, desk fans and stick insects or something. And, and then recording it and playing it and seeing what you can make.
Yeah, I think I... A guy called Sonny, who recorded a couple of my albums, actually, he was telling me about a guy he knew that did that as a job. And it's funny, you think about all these like gory, threatening scenes that you see in movies that have like really quite intense scenes, you know, and you find out what the sound effect of, I don't know, like someone's bone breaking or something really gory happening, it's just like some kind of innocent vegetable being stabbed. You know? it's quite a funny like juxtaposition. Maybe I'd miss, you know, pitch and rhythm and some kind of organized things that I love about
innocent vegetable as opposed to like the guilty ones that fully deserve to be destroyed. I was just thinking about when I was at the Northern, there's a piano player who studied there called Tom Taylor. And Chris Potter came for 3 days. It's like the best 3 days of my life.
Great.
Even better than her honeymoon. and one night he came up to the jam that we had in the student union after his gig.
Yeah.
And he came up and first of all, like, he was totally on his own, and he comes over because we'd done this big band thing with him for a few days, and he sees me and Tom, and so he sort of sidles up to us. Oh, hi guys, you know, how's it going? That was a cool gig, you know, maybe you guys going to play in this jam? We're like, yeah. And then Tom scurries off for a minute, at which point I remember like saying the dumbest thing I could think of about like how Dave Holland is English and lives in New York. It didn't go very well for me. But at this point, Tom came back with two beers in two hands, and he gave them both to Chris. And Chris was like, I'm not really going to drink. And Tom was like, scouse and nervous. And he was like, ah, f***ing get it, Tanya. He looked terrified. But Chris played piano at the jam. And it was really cool.
Wow.
He played Stella. And I remember Tom. Obviously, when you're at college, our perspective's not as good as it should be. But I remember Tom being really confused and upset that Chris Potter was better than him at the piano. Oh, it was really funny. And then I was like, because I asked him once about practice and he said he just only would practice the piano.
Oh, Chris Potter.
Yeah, and a little bit of saxophone at the end.
Okay.
But I never practiced the piano and I'm terrible at it.
Yeah.
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 Maybe you should, I mean.
It's not too late, is it?
Yeah. It's never too late. I think piano is amazing. Like, the great thing about learning the piano is it kind of teaches you about, like, all music in a way. Like,
yeah.
The ability to explore harmony using a piano.
Yeah.
To some extent, yeah. Right? There's obviously things harmonically a piano can't do, but, yeah, and rhythm and coordination and, yeah, loads of musicianship skills, I think, can be developed on the piano, so... I was very grateful to, it to have been part of my life since very young.
I like to call it the Google Maps of musical instruments.
It's true, yeah.
When did you move from piano to trumpet then?
I would rather say trumpet joined the family.
I'd rather not say.
When I was in primary school, there was, opportunity to have like group brass lessons, which is very exciting because this hadn't happened in my primary school before. It was brand new when I started. And
was this during like a music service?
Yeah, I think it was. I think it was something to do with Hampshire Music Service. And I, this really lovely lady, Jane Bryden, came and gave these group lessons. And I started, I think I was in about year four. What would that be, like eight or nine? And I think. Yeah, perhaps because I'd been learning piano, I had a bit of a head start when it came to, like, just general music and reading music and that sort of thing. So it was just about getting my head around how to play the instrument, you know, the technique of it. I'm still trying to do that now, you know. it was very funny. There used to be this old program on Channel 4 called Driver, which was kind of meant to be a bit like Top Gear or whatever. I don't know if anyone knows it, but they were looking for some kids to play brass instruments in the programme to advertise this particular type of car. And they got in touch with the primary school, not realising that the brass lessons had only been going on for a week. And we had to play... But being, you know, a cool opportunity, the school were like, yeah, sure, they'll do it. We had to play... Postman Pat, theme tune from Postman Pat in the back of a Toyota Yaris, and it was like a red one, you know, so they were kind of saying, oh, this is like it's a car, but it's kind of like a little van, you know, and there's loads of space.
So
there's this very funny archive footage out there somewhere of me looking cross-eyed at my vowels and my trumpet playing the first phrase of Postman Pat, and then I think the last little bit of the tune was way too high for me to get the note out, so it's quite funny. But I think a friend of mine's dad's got it on videotape.
Wow, that would be amazing to try.
That was my TV debut.
I'd like to see that.
Yeah.
And then maybe you could overdub. Yeah. With like solo you could do a shred. Shred.
To make it like really good. The opposite. Of
Yeah, that sounds perfect. So your first trumpet was one that you must have like been renting from school.
Well, I actually, my dad's one of many children. He's one of nine. And, one of his brothers had a trumpet from when he was younger, which he just didn't really use. And was just sort of lying around in his flat. So I, was able to borrow it, which I guess was brilliant for my parents because they didn't, you know, instruments can be expensive things. And it meant that there was this trumpet I could borrow and get used to playing on before I decided that, I really did love it. And then later on I got my own trumpet. That was really handy that an uncle of mine had a trumpet.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
that adds to the list of questions that I've asked with a presumptive nature that have almost always turned out to be untrue. And I've done them, I've done like 15 now, where I've gone, excited. Oh, that must mean this, or
go on, I assume.
Well, like what I just said to you, you must have rented it, right?
Oh,
I could have just
yeah.
said, where'd you get that trumpet? Oh, how'd you get a trumpet?
That's all right, but it's, I do that. You're a risk taker.
Yeah, I'd love to take risks, but they've not a single one has paid off yet. So do you remember your first, like, musical influences, or the first things you listened to that you thought were cool, or first things that you were playing?
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, probably the most honest answer to that question and the most truthful one must have been, like, a load of, like, 90s pop, like checking out all those music channels, like yeah. Smash Hits,
yeah,
Kerrang.
There was
no
real...
Smash Hits isn't cool. Kerrang, Q, that sort of thing.
There was a boom.
There was a boom when we were about eight or nine. Yeah,
and
that was the
Sky
thing.
Sky came along when Sky Digital replaced like analog Sky, and then suddenly, as well as VH1, there was like MTV. MTV Bass was one, and
oh yeah,
there was another one, an MTV like a middling MTV like. Citrus or some weird stuff in the middle.
Yeah.
And then Smash Hits, Kerrang.
Yeah.
What else?
Kiss.
Yeah.
Magic.
That's quite
old
yeah.
school. But I, as well as like 90s pop,
yeah.
going into the 2000s, I actually got into jazz quite young age as well. So, I think because I liked improvising, I started playing trumpet and that sort of thing. I started joining some like local youth jazz bands.
Mm-hmm.
I joined my local like youth county youth jazz orchestra, and it was there that I met people who would maybe like mention names to me, like Miles Davis or whatever. And so I started to then build up a bit of a record collection. You know, the classic thing of you buy a Miles Davis album, and then you look at who's playing on the album and you're like, oh, I wonder what their own albums sound like. And then from that moment on, I kind of started to buy jazz albums, you know.
Yeah.
So that was...
Oh, that's such a classy place to start.
Oh, I know. Yeah. Miles. Begins and ends with Miles. It's great. But, and then I was always playing classical piano, and I love and still do love classical music. So that was the thing that was bubbling alongside. So, and I think as I got into my later teens and sort of into sixth form, I got into classical music and perhaps some more obscure jazz musicians or some a wider variety of jazz musicians in a very big way, you know, at kind of the age of 16, 17. So that was a very, very exciting time for me, that age.
And then around that age you did like music college auditions.
Yeah, did.
And how did you find out about college in the first place? Do you remember?
I was so lucky growing up, because actually, talking about my first piano teacher, she was my piano teacher from the age of 5 to 18. So until I left home, really, and I'm still very much in contact with her. She's an amazing lady called Pam Edwards, and she went to the Royal Academy and studied classical piano. So she was very kind of, she knew about the world of, you know, going to music college, and she knew lots of people who were still involved in that world. And I think all my teachers in secondary school and at sixth form, I had an amazing musical experience at sixth form, and they were all very clued up on music college. And I used to actually, I went to the Royal Academy like for some one-to-one lessons with a just kind of privately, but with a teacher called Mark David, who's now head of brass actually at the Royal Academy. But I used to, couple of years before I moved to London, I used to go every now and again to have lessons with him. And I a lot of my musical friends like were interested in auditioning for music colleges, so you get to know things about the different colleges, and you find out I never went to any junior departments or anything, but you, because I was really into music and had good sort of well-connected music teachers, they would tell me about all those things. And yeah, so, yeah, that really
Did you always know you'd go on a jazz course?
I wasn't particularly 100% sure, but, because I actually wanted to go to music college, like, even when I was, like, just starting secondary school. That was always my thing. I wanted to go and study music, but I didn't know whether that would be in the form of, like, playing jazz or classical trumpet or whatever. I think the likelihood was... more likely to become jazz, like, as I got older. And when I actually did the auditions, I was almost pretty sure that that's what I wanted to do, you know. But I did, just for fun, almost, and just to see what would happen, I did an audition, one classical audition at the Royal Academy.
Mm-hmm.
Mainly, actually, just for the experience,
yeah.
She says, weeping into her declination. I partly think that perhaps if my heart was set more on the classical thing, I could have perhaps pushed that part of my playing to a level and maybe auditioned in more places and perhaps got in somewhere. But I actually didn't get into the Academy as a classical player. But I auditioned in loads of places for jazz and... Mm-hmm. Was lucky that went all right for me. So
yeah,
I was really up for the jazz thing by the time I actually did the auditions, I think.
Yeah, and then you went to Trinity for 4 years.
Yeah,
4 happy years.
Yeah, really happy years.
Did you ever struggle at any points in music college life, or have any challenges that you faced, or ever feel like it wasn't where you wanted to be, or was it always fantastic?
Yeah, I think I had a very positive time at music college and met some wonderful, like, musicians who were, you know, in my year and in other years, and as well as teachers. If there's one thing I might say was different compared to what I was experiencing before, is like the sixth form college I went to was this amazing place called Alton College, and it was run by this, sadly passed away a few years ago now, but this great, great head of music called Martin Reed. And maybe being a sixth form college, like separate to any school, it had almost like a kind of university feel to the place. And I only really, I was pretty much always in the music department. I didn't really take any other subjects as A-levels. And there was such a broad amount of music that I was learning about when I was there, you know, like classically, like jazz-wise, and in terms of like rock and pop music and loads of stuff. I kind of, yeah, that place was an absolute fountain of knowledge for me with all of that. So perhaps going in, like when I went to Trinity, where my course was kind of all about jazz music, I loved that, obviously, because that's what I wanted to do. But it meant that the other side of things I had to kind of nurture on my own. And in fact, I was lucky because there were so many teachers at Trinity that were able to assist with that, and I had composition lessons whilst I was there studying trumpet as well, and of course I was still just like going to concerts, checking stuff out anyway off my own back, you know, outside of the course I was studying. And I actually found the course was kind of chilled out enough for me to really just do my thing, actually.
Yeah.
So in a way it was just like a wonderful way to move to London and meet new people in a wonderful part of London. Actually, I really love Greenwich, and a great building to study in, great teachers, and it was just 4 years to really facilitate me kind of finding my feet and becoming a professional musician. Yeah. I guess.
How did you know that was the college for you then? Was that like the place you really wanted to go?
Funnily enough, no, like I always had my heart set on going to the Royal Academy of Music for some reason. Like, I don't know, it's just maybe the prestige of it, you hear about it. That was always where I wanted to go, you know, the Royal Academy of Music, study jazz. And then it wasn't until, in fact, yeah, after my auditions, actually, I kind of suddenly had a bit of a, like, yeah, think about it all in a deep way. And part, there was a reason I wanted to go to Trinity. And it's very specific to that time, you know. I'm not sure what the case would be now, you know, because everywhere's, you know, got its pros and cons. And to be honest, I think all the jazz courses are amazing in their own way, you know. But for me at that time, for various reasons, Trinity was completely calling me somehow. Yeah. And yeah, I think you just have to listen to your instincts.
Yeah.
That's been, yeah, something I'm really kind of passionate about, actually, just being instinctive. And yeah, I think maybe that was a strange one for my parents or whatever, because I was always so excited and up for the idea of going to the academy.
Yeah.
And then just explaining to them, I'd completely changed my mind, was a funny one. Yeah. They were really cool about it, obviously. Yeah. They've always been very supportive, but I just had to, like, explain why that was. And yeah, it was very much because of what was happening at that particular time.
Yeah.
It's maybe a slightly transitional thing going on at the academy at that moment.
Yeah.
And yeah, mainly the positives at Trinity at that time were really just beckoning me in some way. Yeah.
I guess partly, like, a lot of the same teachers work in the same colleges. Like, it's, I remember, true, when I had some lessons before my auditions with Martin Speak, and he was like, well, if you get into Academy, you're going to have me as your teacher. If you get into Trinity, you're going to have me as your teacher. It's like, don't get bent out of shape too much about it. But then he was like, oh, but don't forget, you might not get in anywhere.
Yeah.
He was like,
yeah. Yeah. It's great. Like, at Trinity, I had Chris Batchelor, amazing trumpet player, for my whole 4 years at Trinity, actually. Yeah. And yeah, around 16, 17, whilst I was at sixth form, I was like, I massively got into Loose Tubes and that kind of generation of musicians, the likes of Django Bates and Mark Lockhart and Chris, and massively love their music. So, yeah, it was exciting to me that he taught there, that's for sure.
Yeah. And then Mark, has he produced some of your albums since?
No, actually.
What has he done?
He helped when we made the Chaos Orchestra album. Yeah. Like, he very much helped with that. But saying that, like, he has been a massive source of wisdom and advice as regards to just being a musician and what you do. Massively grateful. He's been very generous with his time and his words. And he, when I first had the idea to record this music I'd written whilst I was at Trinity, which was my first album, Landing Ground, was a result of me exploring writing for some improvisers plus string quartet, something I did whilst I was at Trinity. I just wanted, like, a little project to get stuck into compositionally. And, wrote a load of music, some of which I kind of scrapped, you know, didn't go on the album. But I ended up with these pieces, and it was only after having written the music over a few years that I was like, oh, I should record this, you know. It'd be nice to have a document of it. So that music was never written with the intention of making an album, but it just seemed like it would be a real shame not to document it. And, yeah, Mark was amazing at, like, helping me find a studio and recommending engineers and helping me with all the kind of... I self-released that album in a way, so teaching me about all that kind of stuff. And yeah, and I have to say, like, he's a musician I really admire, just in terms of his persistence and his, yeah, he's got this wonderful, positive, breezy attitude to life, I think, and making music. And yeah, because of that, he's always got a project on the go, like, something that he's up to musically. Yeah. I don't think he would, you know, he's a happy man when he's making music with other people and composing, and that really resonates with me. So yeah, he's definitely a musician I massively admire from that point of view. And of course, I completely love his writing and his improvising. I think it's totally wonderful. Yeah.
I remember he sat in when we recorded the Chaos album.
Yes,
and you'd come out, like, I remember coming out from one take, and he was just like, Rob, that sounded really nice. Like, I must have played like a minim, like a high note or something, you know? But he was so generous and so like that kind of, those moments when like it, like that studio was small and quite hot,
very small,
you know, and to come out and you think that like this, like he's there and he's really like interested in all the parts of the music and how it's all fitting together and really generous with his support as well. I was really, I don't think I'd ever really spoke to him before that, but straight away I was like, man, this guy is something, you know?
Yeah, and I think the way he plays as well, like, there's, you know how there's some people that really seem to, like, truly improvise when they improvise?
Yeah.
It sounds silly.
No, I know what you mean.
He really does seem to do that, and, yeah, people who manage to somehow channel the moment, you know?
Yeah.
Like, which takes, yeah, I guess to get in that state of inspiration is a challenge, but he's, yeah, he often seems to, yeah, improvise and get to that space, and I always find that really exciting. And he actually, having got to know Mark a little bit playing in, studying at Trinity, and also we both now play in a Jasper Hoybees band, Fellow Creatures, which is very exciting. Mark always talks about this thing that jazz musicians have where you have a visit. And having a visit is that very exciting moment when every now and again, you know, the gods of music shine down on you and you have like a little, like transcendental, outer body musical experience. Kind of saying it jokingly, but this is serious, you know, this is very profound, you know. And obviously, if we could have a visit every time we put an instrument in our mouth, that would be quite impressive. But, you know, visits don't come all the time.
Wow.
But it's our goal in life to try and channel the visit as much as possible. Try and have a visit, you know.
That's amazing.
Yeah, there we go. He's taught me a lot of funny little things like that, you know.
Yeah.
So, great, great guy.
Yeah, he seems like he's the best educator I know for saying things that little sentences. He did not, like, one class for 1 hour at Academy was my only involvement with him before Chaos Orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, and this sounds like one of those annoying cliches that people say that's never true, but honestly, you know, some of the ideas he threw out there have, like, been absolutely life-saving to me. Just little things like, if you can't write a tune, or if you're not getting anywhere with it, like, record yourself on your phone and just play for half an hour and then go and listen to it back and pick a bit, you know, things like that. That is not like, it's not going into like detailed harmonic issues or anything. It's just like, we must have been having a talk on lots of different ways to get composition started. But since that day, you know, it's just really nice to, but I still think about loads of those things that he said.
He's got this, you know, important to let the listeners know about probably the best piece of advice that I've ever been given.
Yeah.
From Mark Lockhart, saxophonist and composer.
Yeah.
And that is about being careful when you're out on the road not to get gig foot.
What's that?
So, gig foot is, you know, often when you go on stage and sound checks and stuff, there's a real danger of, like, bits of gaffer tape being lying around, you know.
Yeah.
On, you know, that, like, the sound guys are using.
Yeah.
Bit of, or duct tape, you know. Yeah. There's all kinds of different tapes. It's a very hazardous area, really, when it comes to tape. So he sort of, one of the main things he said to me is just be so careful not to get that on your shoe when you're walking, like, on a gig. So, yeah.
Why? But why?
Beware,
people. There's tape everywhere.
Yeah.
I should probably have taped down some of these leads for health and safety.
I mean, the home environment, you shouldn't have to worry about gig foot too much.
Okay.
It's very much an on-the-road thing. Yeah. And the more gigs I do, the more I recognise that gig foot is a bit of an epidemic in the jazz community.
Then it's happening a lot.
I mean, it must be worse for, like, rock musicians or something, because they probably... probably got more gear.
A lot more equipment.
Bigger stages, more tape.
Yeah.
But...
Yeah.
Yeah.
We were watching Birdland last night. Have you seen that film?
Is this Birdland or Birdman?
Birdman. We were watching Birdman last night.
I not can Birdland. Genuinely say that's it's one of my favourite films.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What a beauty. We didn't know what we were getting in for, but obviously flipped it over. I have to read the box before we start. They're like, score by Antonio Sanchez. Okay, this will be cool. But there's one called, he's obviously got a cameo in it where, like, the drum kit. I might say some things now that are heinously untrue, but it sounds like the kit is massive and there's loads of different drums and loads of different cymbals. But in the cameo, he's got like a cymbal and a snare, like a really small jazz kit. I've forgotten what the point of this story was now. What's the point of this story?
I don't know.
Oh, well.
I just warned you about Bigfoot. Yeah, maybe it's related to that.
Let's go off topic. Let's go dangerously off. So, as well as Birdman, tell us about some of your other favourites.
Films. You got
favourite films?
Well, yeah, I mean, so I like watching films. I'd be lying if I said I'm some absolute film buff.
Yeah. Would you prefer a film or a TV series?
Oh, it could go either way. Depends.
Okay.
Yeah, Birdman, I love that because it's got that slightly... The story, it's a very kind of human story. It's not, like, too intense, whatever. I just like... It's not a film that... it's not made, like, it's not... How do I say this? You don't get films made about something like that every day. It's quite a unique subject area and story, you know, about this guy, and it's, yeah, the soundtrack's cool. I just think the whole way it's made, the way it's shot is really, really engaging.
Yeah.
It's the way, like, slightly, like, it things that aren't real happen, and I just, aesthetically, it's just super exciting to me, and, I need to watch it again. I haven't watched it since it came out in the cinema, and I remember just loving it. And I should watch it again. But other like general kind of films that I like to watch, or kind of story, the type of story or things that I like kind of kind of thriller esque kind of like real human stories, like anything like, you know, epic, like American Gangster or something, you know, like things that are just like really epic and like on the edge kind of real stories, like quite like that. I'm not a massive film of the other film that I remember really liking, like, massively, was that film with Philip Seymour Hoffman called The Master.
Have you seen that?
We've seen that.
I can't remember who's the... Paul Thomas Anderson. So he's done a lot of those kinds of things. And I love that.
Let's talk about being a female in jazz. It's not much of a man's world the way I think... it could be misconstrued to be, or it would be an art form in which on the outside you could easily, I believe, make the mistake of thinking it's a man's world, but I don't think it is.
No.
Might edit all that out because I don't think anyone wants my opinion.
This is a man's world.
Little
James Brown.
Yeah, it's time more people listen to men's opinions
on women in jazz.
On women in jazz. Yeah, there's too many women discussing
men's opinions on women in jazz.
That's going to
be about the trumpet.
Yeah. So, do you think you've ever been treated differently being a female jazz musician, for better or worse, or?
Yeah, I can't say that when it comes to my peers and people I play with, I don't feel like I have, actually.
Yeah.
I think, my generation, and I guess this is always going to improve, like, our generation, we're very lucky to, you know, attitudes as regards to, like, sexism and equality and things like that, it's much more progressive than it ever has been before, and... I feel fortunate that, yeah, my peers and friends and colleagues have, I've never really felt any kind of, yeah, I felt like I've been treated any differently and just felt like, you know, a fellow musician. And I think particularly maybe with jazz musicians, like the world of jazz music is like full of some of the most progressive and enlightened minds I've ever come across, you know. Yeah. So in that sense, you know, you're surrounded by people who wouldn't even give it a thought, you know.
Yeah.
But I'd say perhaps the one thing I have maybe noticed is just the fact that it's not every day an improvising female trumpet player comes along, and I understand that that is, I'd say, in some way noticeable to people, you know. Yeah. I don't really know what else I can say about it other than that. I'd hate to ever feel like that was the reason I was getting an opportunity or whatever. So for me, it's never really been something I've thought about. I just love writing music and playing music and practicing and trying to get better. And I am, of course, aware that, you know, it's not every day, like I said. So in that sense, it's probably made what I'm doing slightly notable, which, you know, I'm grateful for in a way, because, you know, the more people I can communicate with artistically, you know, the better, I guess.
Yeah. Let's talk about Elliot. How long have you been together?
We have been together just over 7 years.
Right.
Yeah.
Was this a thing that happened? In case this doesn't make sense, Laura's partner, Elliot Galvin, he's a piano player of average abilities.
Average affair.
but a piano player nonetheless. When you met, was this like... Were you in the same year at college?
Yeah, we were in the same year at Trinity.
Oh, cool. So how long did you know each other?
We kind of met at Trinity. Beforehand, we had mutual teachers, like, that taught jazz. We both knew this guy, Mick Foster, who Elliot had teaching him at Junior Trinity, and I had teaching me at Alton College.
Yeah.
And Mick had told when I had him as sixth form, he told me about this guy, Elliot Galvin, who was also going to...
Is he trying to, like, fix you two up?
Well, maybe. We like to call him Uncle Mick. Yeah. I think he was aware that we both had very broad interests and both had very similar interests in musically and artistically. So he told me about this guy, Elliot, that was going to Trinity as well. And of course we met, and I remember being immediately struck by how many things we had in common. That sounds a bit, you know, cheesy or whatever, but
So as soon as you met, you were like, okay.
Well, I was just, like, excited that there was this other person out there that was just as excited by Alfred Schnittke as they were, you know, Miles Davis, as they were, even, like, non-musical things, as they were, like, Van Gogh or, Picasso or certain types of films, and just broadly and artistically someone who was into so many different things and not just mad about jazz. Because you do, when you go, as you know, if you go and study on a jazz course, like, everyone is in so intensely into jazz music that it's like this crazy mad niche world. And obviously that was so exciting as well, because I love, you know, I absolutely adore jazz music, and meeting loads of other people that were into it was such an exciting thing, and being able to talk about it until 5 a.m. in the morning was brilliant. But yeah, you know, coming across Elliot, who was also into all this other music and art that I also loved, I think I just recognised that was quite unique, you know. I think he thinks about improvising music in a very similar way to me, I think. And obviously we have our differences and stuff, but aesthetically, like, I think a lot of the time we're on the same page, which is really exciting.
Although we did almost meet before that over MySpace.
Before we went to music college, Laura messaged me on MySpace and asked me if I was up for having a recording session with her.
No. So how long did you know each other before you got together?
A couple of months.
Right. I've always imagined you two that, and I'm just going to throw some stuff out there,
go on.
You have a completely separate, like, personal and musical relationship.
Yeah, we really don't get on personally.
No. But
yeah.
That's just how it comes across to me as an outsider looking in, you know, that thing that you say when you do rehearsals, that you, like, leave your friendships at the door or whatever. Not that you're, like, mean to each other or anything, but you never behave any differently to each other when you're playing than you do anyone else, you know?
Yeah.
Never, like, heard you yelling, like, I love you. Try to play a solo. This one's for Laura.
I actually think in quite a conscious way, when we're because obviously Elliot plays keyboard in my band Dinosaur alongside Corey and Connor. And when we're in that setting, we're just like four friends, you know.
Yeah.
Four great friends. And I don't feel like... Yeah, that's one of the reasons I think it works really well. Because, you know, like, the guy's my best mate, you know.
Yeah.
He's brilliant.
Yeah.
No one needs that other dynamic going on and interfering with, like, you know, music and
yeah.
And so when you're with other people, you want to be with other people as well, you know.
Do you compose a lot together? How does that work at home?
No, like, we both. I suppose that's a funny thing. We're both composers, and we're often both working at home. So yeah, we're both writing very different music in different rooms.
Yeah.
When we lived in a smaller, we lived in like a little basement flat in Greenwich. And to be honest, like, I can't complain at all because I'm a trumpet player and I spend the first couple of hours of my day, most days, doing horrible long notes and sometimes very loud. And poor Elliot has to, like, you know, exist within that. I don't know, we find a way to make it work. But obviously now we have a slightly bigger space and I have, like, my own room to make noise in. And but it is quite funny and, like, it's pretty cacophonous when we're both at home writing music and making sound. But it's cool, you know. It's
good. I can well believe it. It seems like you have this, like, really idyllic balance because loads of albums, like, I can think of quite a few musical instances in which people in relationships have tried to then include them musically and it doesn't, I think, and I'm going to probably cut this out because it's probably not true, but I think I remember after Michael Brecker died that Randy Brecker, his brother, replaced Mike in the Brecker Brothers with his either wife or girlfriend on the tenor.
Ooh,
yeah.
That would sound like something that Randy Brecker would
do. It was just called the Breckers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not the Brecker Brothers.
Yeah, it does sound like something he'd do, and I'm fairly sure that did happen. But just in case, I'll take that out.
Yeah,
if not.
Liable.
But, like, with Dinosaur, does one of you own that? Is that a collective, or is that your band?
Oh, I feel very lucky to say that that's my band.
Okay.
I write the music for that. And, you know, we started out being called the Laura Jebb Quartet and played for many years, but, you know, it just felt... The longer we played, it felt more and more like a band, and the kind of music we were playing, you know, that title didn't seem to fit right. So, I feel so lucky that, you know, I met these three other musicians when I was at music college, and it just works.
Have you ever considered replacing Elliot or started a new project and been like, maybe it's time for a change?
I did record my second album, Human Spirit.
Yeah.
Shock Horror didn't have any piano on it, which could only mean one thing. That was no idea.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was a very hard year. You know?
Yeah.
No, I'm joking. At home, I'm now, I'm joking. But no, I think, you know, I think we're both very... like, chilled about that sort of thing, and
the lovely thing about jazz music. It's, you know, words like better or worse are a bit useless somehow because everyone's so individual, you know.
Yeah.
You know, he's not Elliot's Elliot, you know. Elliot Galvin, you know, you want him to play in your band because he's Elliot Galvin. He plays like that. He's not just a good piano player.
Yeah.
That's how I think of it. So quite often when I hear piano, I hear it being played by Elliot. Therefore, that's what I'm looking to write for. But, you know, that doesn't mean to say it would be a bad thing if I played with other piano players, yeah. And I certainly have done a fair bit of that. But yeah,
but I'm just
totally chuffed that Elliot. So I totally love his piano playing, and
in
Dinosaur that just works so brilliantly. Yeah. You know, so, and I feel the same about Corey and Connor actually. Yeah.
Yeah. I looked at your upcoming tour of Ireland, which will be in the past when this is aired.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
You've got a gig every day for 8 days.
That's
a real achievement.
Oh, it's going to be so nice. Yeah. I don't think this band has ever played 8 days in a row, actually.
Yeah.
We've done, like, gigs, like, close to each other before.
Yeah.
I could be wrong in saying that, but I'm pretty sure we haven't done 8 consecutive dates. So it's going to be, you know, we've been really enjoying over the last few months since our album was released last September of playing the music so much, you know, more we've done more live gigs than we've ever done as a band, and it's been such an exciting experience, like seeing how the music and the compositions develop, because, you know, we're gonna play them differently every night, and I guess the more we get to know the music, the more we can kind of stretch out with it. That's the really exciting thing, I guess, about jazz music. And yeah, I'm really intrigued to see what the state of it will be over, like, 8 days, you know.
Yeah,
that would be really cool. Feet.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. It's going to be high risk. Yeah.
The last time I did a gig abroad, I decided that this music needed a bit of a stretching out. It was like a funk band of original compositions. So before one tune, I turned to the band leader and I said, "Do you know what this needs? A solo tenor intro."
Sends the tenor player.
Yeah. And I just started playing. And did a very beautiful little solo tenor intro to his tune. And not only was it the last time I ever played with that band, it was the last time I played out of the country as well. So.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
They've been warned overseas.
Exactly. So if anyone's listening to this wondering why my career's in tatters. Elliot, do you still have your... Do you have a toy piano in the house?
I do have a toy piano.
I wondered if we could try an experiment. This I know I've said a lot of things are experiments.
Yeah.
What I wondered about trying... I was thinking one of the most enjoyable gigs I ever did was, just because of how bizarre it was the time that the three of us did a trio while Greg Sinclair narrated improvised Christmas stories.
I think it was this Christmas we were reminiscing. I was reminiscing about how brilliant. I mean, Greg Sinclair was so great. So he wrote stories.
So spontaneous,
It was really good.
What a great.
And the stories would change based on our playing well.
Yeah.
He'd add to them as well, depending on how we were behaving.
So was he kind of improvising?
He was verbally improvising around a loose idea. So there was one point I remember that he was talking about Santa in his sleigh, and we were obviously getting way out of hand. And then Greg said, obviously there was a lot of turbulence that night, and we were getting worse, and he was just going, load of turbulence.
He was very funny. Actually really enjoyed it. I think we should do that again sometime.
I do, yeah.
Next Christmas. Let's make it a Christmas thing.
I was thinking in hindsight, that's the most successful musical project I was involved in. And I was like, how could I make that into a band? Like, with Greg as like a narrator.
I remember you saying this great thing, which I thought was really nice after that gig. I think you invited your family along, you know.
Yeah,
my mum and sister.
And I remember, because obviously we were doing free improv, which is quite a niche thing, and it's not something that, you know, if people haven't heard anything like that before, you were saying it was really cool because there were these words going on, there was this wonderfully comical narrative going on, delivered by this bubbly northern bloke from Crewe, whose name is the brilliant Greg Sinclair, who, by the way, is a fantastic saxophone player, but just a funny guy as well.
Yeah.
yeah, I think because the words were there, they could really, like, the music was, like, enhancing the narrative and, like, setting the scene, whereas perhaps if the instruments were, like, on their own, it would have been a bit more of the unknown for them, and they might not have known how to, like, listen to it, or it would have just been, you know, something so different that it would be hard to compute. But I thought it was really nice that you said that your family were really really into it.
Great. They were. It was the most engaged my family had ever been with such, like...
With your life.
With my life and playing, and playing something that's quite, like, a niche, like you said.
Yeah.
So my experiment was to ask Laura some quick-fire questions.
Wow.
And whilst I do that, you have to improvise on the toy piano. And maybe if she's taking time to think, you know, to reflect that, or if the answers are quick, to reflect the madness.
Yes, yeah,
I like that.
That I'm probably
going to have a soundtrack.
I know!
So
but
this
I,
is
well,
great. They're just having a nice Saturday.
Yeah, just mind their own business, and it's done.
That's
what
you want.
Yeah. So, Elliot uses this toy piano on his own. I'm just going to fill this silence while he tromps upstairs to get his toy piano. He uses this on his first album, Dreamland.
Yeah,
that's what it's called. I adore the sound of it. It's just the coolest thing.
Oh, that's gonna be great.
That's perfect. All right, yeah, take it away. All right, Laura, favorite trumpet player.
Miles Davis.
What's your favourite album to listen to?
Oh, there's too many I couldn't possibly say, but albums that I love at the moment. Something called Friend Opportunity by Dear Hoof.
Yeah.
The Incredible Bitches Brew by Miles Davis.
Yeah.
There's too many, but there's some things I like at the moment.
What do you think you'd be doing if you weren't a musician?
Musician.
Who's your favourite UK jazz musician?
Oh wow, there's so many, but yeah. I've mentioned a few names already. I absolutely love Chris Batchelor, Mark Lockhart, my peers like Elliot Galvin, Corey Dick.
Yeah,
these guys are just so exciting to me. Yeah.
What's your favourite album to have played on?
Ooh, to have played on. Well, I've only really played on my own albums, but I really, really enjoyed making Jasper Hoiby's Fellow Creatures album. That's really, really fun.
Favourite TV series?
Ooh, TV series. The Night Manager. That was great. Oh, and probably Breaking Bad, but that's absolutely classic.
Interesting.
Breaking Bad and The Night Manager are good examples of, like, yeah, I love that kind of, like, gritty crime, really intense thing.
Yeah. favorite film?
Favorite film, Birdman.
Favorite food?
Favorite food. Wow, I absolutely love Italian food and Indian food too. But maybe if I had to choose one, the Italian food.
If you could have a tube station from here to any point in London, where would you want that tube to come out at the end?
Greenwich.
Well, Laura Judd, thank you so much for coming on the Jazz Podcast.
Yeah, thanks, Rob.
Our pleasure to have you. And Elliot, for the toy piano, thank you so much.
Wow, that was great.
Yeah.
We have 1,004 total plays.
How do you know that?
It says on Buzzsprout.
What? Where?
Go to stats, mate.
Oh, for goodness sake, I've been doing it myself with a calculator.
You have every episode.
Oh, man, every day I've been adding them up myself. Oh,
Rob, what are you like?
That really hurts. That is really annoying. Well.
You just go to stats and then it says like every episode and then it does a total.
I can see that now, and boy, do I feel stupid.
Yeah. I know you didn't want to reveal the stats, but they're kind of...
At key moments, 1,000 total plays, probably 5,000, 10,000, 50,000, 100,000, 1 million.
Yeah.
The Jazz Podcast will be running
up into the late 2080s, as we discussed last week. So there's every chance that we'll get to 100,000, not because we're growing in number, but just because we're going to wear people down by running for so many years.
Well, look, we've been going for since the 3rd of February, so with that kind of trajectory, what will we hit, do you think, in our lifetime?
Over 500,000 people. That's way more people than there are fans of jazz.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Our next week is Dave Green.
Oh, Dave Green. That was a nice episode to record.
Yeah, that was the first jazz podcast field trip. All right. Here we go.
Cool. Well, have a good week.
You too, lads.
See you next week.
Yeah, I'll speak to you on Friday.
Nice. I have to say that the intro is probably my favourite thing about the jazz podcast, and no one's commented on it, Rob.
No, I haven't received a single word either way.
Is it people not enjoying that?
Maybe we just enjoy it too much.
I don't know, I'm just... If I was listening to the jazz podcast, I'd tune out as we start talking.
I do that. I just listen to the first 15 seconds.
Yeah, because it's such a great track.
That's beautiful, isn't it?
Garrett. And then I think Woody does such a good job of the intro.
Yeah.
It's a shame.
A big shame.
I have had some nice messages, though, of you saying...